Today, I have a very special episode for you, which is more of a discussion style rather than an interview, as I get to hang out with Sarah Scott, Bo Wilson, and Jess Mulhall. So as many of you know, my life's mission is to empower mothers to use homeopathy in their home. And part of this empowerment journey, I feel, is also having an empowered birth, which is what today's conversation is all about. I really feel that if we can just give mothers back their power as the true and also the first healers in their home, then we can heal the planet. An empowered mother is one who is in tune with her own intuition, her own deep knowing. It's a mama who can advocate for her children and who does not fall prey to anxiety, because inside herself, she knows who she is, and no amount of bullying from supposed authorities is going to make her waver in her belief in herself and her children's ability to heal naturally. Much of this, I believe, starts in pregnancy, and definitely so during our birthing experience. Birthing our babies in an empowered manner, whatever that looks like for you as the individual, is what sets you up for a great bonding experience with your child, and it brings us so much closer to reclaiming our inner lioness. So come and join me in this fun conversation, and let's reclaim our right to an empowered birthing experience.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangouts. Today is a super special, lovely conversation that I'm going to have with three gorgeous women. I'm so excited to bring them all on. I have got the lovely Bo Wilson with me, who is a return guest. Bo is a midwife and also a childbirth educator. She is also studying to be a homeopath and also works with me, which is amazing. Welcome to the show, Bo.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
And I have the lovely Sarah Scott, who's been a homeopath on my team for over a year now, I think. Hey, Sarah.
Yeah, over a year.
Yeah, and also a return guest. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Eugenie.
And we have the lovely Sarah's sister, Jess Mulhall, who is a midwife as well over in Melbourne. Welcome to the show, Jess.
Thank you for having me.
It's just amazing to have you ladies on. I asked you to come on the show because day in, day out, all day long, I have women coming into the clinic bawling their eyes out because they didn't get the birth that they wanted. And all throughout the pregnancy, procedures were forced on them that they didn't want. And when it's your first baby, especially, you just don't know what you don't know. And I sometimes feel that no amount of childbirth education classes, no amount of chatting with your aunties and your sisters, or nothing can really prepare you for what you're in for. But there's certain things and certain knowledge that we can gain that is going to make the process a lot easier. So that's why I wanted to bring us all together. Sarah, what sort of things are you seeing in your clinic when mums are telling you about their birth stories? What's sort of the general consensus that you hear? Because definitely on my end, it's a lot of things were forced on me that I didn't want to. I didn't know I had a choice. Mums being traumatized by their births. And actually, I had a lady yesterday who, she was actually fine with her first birth, but it wasn't until she had a second birth, it was absolutely beautiful, that she then knew how it could be, that then she actually had relived trauma from her first birth. So what sort of things are you hearing in clinic as a homeopath?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of trauma around with birth and the type of birth people get to experience versus what they had wanted. But I see a lot of people going into their pregnancy journey very unsure of what they do want and how to sort of curate the birth that they would like. And they get presented with, or they come across a stumbling block during the pregnancy, like the placenta's lying too low, and they're being told the only option now is cesarean. And they think that's it. And they come to you absolutely desperate. And there's this desperation to do something else. I think women have been disempowered to take full control of their pregnancies and birth. And it kind of gets outsourced sometimes to the hospitals and the medical system. So it's really great when women come to us as homeopaths or as birth workers that sort of hold the women's hand and say, I'm going to teach you something and show you a way that you can change this story and it can have a different ending for you. And we open up the possibilities for women to have a different type of birth story. Now, sometimes it ends up being the cesarean anyway, and if that's the journey, that's absolutely fine. But I think when you have a modality like homeopathy, or you've got, you know, your Bo's doing the birth education and Jessica's doing hypnobirthing, when you've got all of these other things brought into it, I think you're allowing the women the chance to be really 100% involved in their pregnancy and how to direct their birth journey a bit more. So I just love that that's what we're able to do in clinic, that we're able to just show them that there's another possibility. We open up these possibilities for women, which I just think is amazing. So yeah, placenta previa is a big one that I see people really panicking about, and it responds really well to homeopathy. I've seen probably 7 clients with placenta previa now, so not a huge amount, but 100% success rate of moving it, and they're having a different story by the end of it. Now, sometimes it still ends up in the cesarean for other reasons, and sometimes that's through pressure again for a different reason. New pressure has come from the medical system, but the majority of women have gone on to have the birth they're able to have with a little bit of support, rather than being told, this is the end of the road with this, and you now have to take this path. So I just love that we have that opportunity to open up some things for women.
That is cool. I've only had 1 placenta previa move, and I just used the remedy made from placenta. I haven't had many of those cases. But strep B is one that I've often managed to help women avoid antibiotics. You know, they're strep B positive, and you give them the strep B homeopathic nosode, and then they test negative. I had a lady once test negative within 1 week. I said to her, I don't think the remedy is going to work that quickly, but here you go. And it worked. I just couldn't believe it. So from that angle, it's pretty amazing if you're working with homeopath right from the start. Bo, what would you say is the birth scene like in Perth? Because we've got listeners from all over the world, and I think even from the East Coast to the West Coast, the birthing scene probably differs quite a lot, and you've got experience in both. And most of my clients are here in Perth. So what sort of things are you seeing in the birth scene in Perth?
Yeah, so I think I actually trained in Queensland and New South Wales as a midwife, and coming to WA, it was a massive change. In Queensland, where I trained, there was a lot of more midwifery-led models of care, and even in hospital-based birthing systems, the midwives led most of the care, unless the woman had a really complex pregnancy. But coming to WA, I was quite shocked because, as you mentioned with the Group B strep, it's routinely screened here. Women are not given an option most of the time. It's just sort of like, okay, it's your 36-week appointment. We're going to give you a blood test, and that'll include Group B strep. And it's really not given as an option at all. Whereas in Queensland, it was actually only offered mostly to women who had risk factors or maybe had a previous positive screen in a previous pregnancy. And I know, I believe in the UK, at least until quite recently, it's been similar. And yeah, here in WA, the maternity system is very, very obstetric led. So obstetricians lead a lot of the care. Even in more low risk pregnancies, the obstetricians really do manage a lot of things. And I feel that what I realized as a midwife, a lot of the power and expertise and autonomy of midwives has been taken away from us. So when I trained, I learned how to suture and to cannulate in Queensland. I came to WA. They didn't want a bar of midwives doing those things, which is a real shame because I had to call up a doctor to come into the room to do those things and break that continuity of care that I've just established with the woman. Although I didn't always follow the rules there. But just advocating for, you know, can I suture? This is a woman who I've just worked with, and she knows me and she's comfortable with me doing this. And the obstetric staff wanting to come in and take control of that is a real shame. But the other part is that here there's a huge demand for private midwives, for women to have independent midwifery care in their home and home births, and there's a huge shortage of private midwives here.
Is that especially since COVID? I had a client just yesterday who said that one of the hospitals she went to, she works as a nurse, they were 50 midwifery staff down, 50.
Yes. Yeah. Even, yes, in the hospital system, they're very, very short staffed. But because this autonomy has been taken away from midwives here especially, it's very hard to actually reach competency to become a private midwife, unfortunately. I've actually become endorsed myself, but we have to do many hours, 5,000 hours in clinical practice. You really do have to actually go work in a hospital to become a private midwife, basically. And, yeah, to brush up on all of those skills that should be just basic part of our midwifery competencies is quite difficult in the hospital system. So I've got women contacting me weekly, trying to find a private midwife here, and they cannot find one. And they're inquiring at 9 or 10 weeks of pregnancy, and they still can't find anyone to look after them.
Wow. Jace, what's the story like over in Melbourne side?
So I'm taking a little break from actually working in the hospitals. So I'm kind of getting my information through the hypnobirthing education that I'm giving. So clients are telling me kind of the challenges they're facing with their care providers. Now, lots of them are going with home birth midwives, so they're having very supportive care, but some others are going with private obstetricians, and they're coming from different states across Australia. And I would say the most recent ones that I've been having are being told that their baby's too big.
Don't get me started on that one.
I know. It really irks me this one. So yeah, people are having scans, they're being told that their baby's too big and, you know, we need to induce you early, or we should do a cesarean section, an elective cesarean section. And, you know, there's been studies done that show that the ultrasound scans can be off by as much as 400 or 800 grams, which is massive. And the only way to accurately measure a baby is to weigh them when they're born. And unfortunately, we can't do that before they're born. So that one really gets to me. The other one is the group B strep as well. So I was working in more rural places in the last couple of years in Queensland and New South Wales. And I definitely felt like the midwives had a lot more autonomy in these smaller hospitals. The doctors kind of knew us and trusted us. So we definitely had a lot more scope to be more autonomous. But with the group B strep one in New South Wales, it's blanket. Everybody gets tested for it unless they're a little bit more educated about the topic and they know that they can say no. But most people, unfortunately, just say yes to it and then most likely end up getting antibiotics in labor. So yeah, that's probably the group B strep and the big baby's story is probably the things I'm seeing the most recently. Yeah.
The big baby story, it really reinforces you can't do it to the woman. Like, you're not capable. Your baby's too big for you to be able to do this. And often the baby's born and it's like 1 or 2 pounds less than the predicted weight. It's just that message of actually, no, you aren't completely built to do this. And this isn't exactly how nature has designed you. And you need the help. You need to outsource this and get someone else in to get you through this. Whereas women are just totally built to do this. We might need to support them through this when they come across stumbling blocks. But that sort of just stripping away that natural knowledge, wisdom, intelligence, consciousness, whatever you want to call it, that women have, that everyone has, but women have for this experience. And just being told, right when you're sort of coming towards the end of it as well, and you have to really psych yourself up to sort of sit in that strength and power of, I'm actually going to do this. I'm going to birth life into this world. And it's like, it's a pretty big wall in front of you to get into that zone. And then to be told, no, you're not going to be able to do this. We're going to have to intervene. And just to take that away from women, to like really pull the rug out at that moment. I can't stand that. I just think that is the most awful thing. I think it's cruel at that point.
It really is. Why do you think we believe obstetricians, or basically when they say this to us, why do we believe them?
I think it's a scary process being pregnant. I think, especially if it's your first, if you haven't done it before, I think the unknown is scary naturally in life. And I think this is such an unknown. Like, you've got the unknown of being a parent, of being a mother, on the other side of it, how you're actually going to interact with your child. So you've got all of those kind of parenting side of unknowns. But the actual experience of birth, we are conditioned to believe that it is horrific, painful, and traumatic, and not desirable. That's what we are conditioned through all sorts of movies and the war stories from our parents and grandparents. And everyone loves to share their awful birth stories, and not enough positive birth stories are being shared. But I think that is so ingrained in, like, I've heard little girls saying, I'm never having kids because it's so painful and awful. Like, my mom told me it was so awful having me. You're just thinking, oh my goodness, that story going through your life. Like, when they actually come to the point, if they do decide to want to have a child as an adult, they'll have that inbuilt into them. So I think we carry that through. So I think we're looking, I think there's the looking for that person to tell us, actually, you're right, we're going to confirm your fears. It is scary. And we can take some of that fear away by taking some control from you and doing it for you. So I think we, like, there's a sense that you almost want to believe someone because it confirms your fears.
It's that authority figure as well. Somebody who appears to, well, they've done all this training for years and have all this experience. So why wouldn't you trust that person to give you the best information and to give you all of the information that you need to make an informed choice? You just assume somebody is going to be telling you something that is going to make you make the safest choice. But if you don't know all of the information, it's not the safest choice for you. And also, you know, in the system these days, there's no time. There's no time for people to sit down and chat with you for 2 hours. You might get 20 minutes with your midwife or your doctor in a big hospital, and they don't have time to make sure you feel okay and make sure you're feeling safe and actually sit down and have a chat with you to see how you are doing. And they have to give you the bullet points, and it might not include everything.
That's such a valid point, just having that time with somebody, because so often, especially if it's your first, we're still working full time, often right up to 38 weeks or 36 weeks. And the thing that always fascinates me is I see these posts in mothers' Facebook groups and this post about what is the best stroller, what's the best baby carrier. And I find mums do endless hours of research on strollers and baby carriers and car seats, but the amount of time they spend on listening to positive birth stories and how to empower themselves in the birth process, I wonder how much time we spend researching that versus the stroller, or the mums who will spend $600,000 on a stroller but will balk at the price to pay for a hypnobirthing course, which I think is one of the, or a childbirth education course, which I think is one of the most empowering things you can possibly do. So I think for any of the mums listening, like, that's spending more time, because I also want to, out of today's conversation, get some tools. Like, I wanted to have our listeners see, hear what it is that we see in practice. And out of this episode, I want them to be able to walk away with tools that they can use to make sure they have as empowered a birth as possible. And I love what Jess said about the time, like making sure you have a natural health practitioner, whether it's homeopath, naturopath, acupuncturist, somebody that actually has time to sit with you and talk with you and check in on how your mental health is doing. Invest in a hypnobirthing or a holistic childcare course, like an active birth workshop, like what Bo's doing, or hypnobirthing, like what Jess is doing. I used to teach hypnobirthing as well, Jess, because I was terrified of giving birth. And then I did hypnobirthing. It empowered me so much that I ended up having two incredible home births. Awesome. Hypnobirthing, I walked in there terrified, like saying, I want all the drugs on the planet. And after about the second or the third class, I said to my husband, we're having a home birth. And he was like, wait, what? So that's what hypnobirthing did for me. And I was so grateful for that. But yeah, making sure that you have somebody that's on your side. And if somebody is giving you BS advice, like your body is growing a baby that's too big for you, that you have like a sane mind there that you can chat to, somebody who can kind of just give you some options, give you some feedback, just put you back into your power. So if you don't have the support network around you, if you have a lot of negative people around you, if you have lots of mums or aunties or people like that, that's going to force you or talk negatively at you, that's going to weaken your self-worth or that little voice that's inside of you, make sure you have some strong woman around you that's going to be able to support you. And if you maybe, something we see often here is people that are from other countries like myself, so they might not have their family around, they might not have many friends around, making sure that you have a good support network around you. And if that then means employing a midwife or naturopath or a homeopath or somebody to advocate for you. Who are some other people that can advocate? I'm just, oh, a doula, I guess. Anyone else? Like, who have you ladies found are good support people?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that, like, in what women can do, the most, probably the start of all of this is like choosing your care provider makes a huge impact on this experience. And like, a lot of women don't know what options there are. They believe that if you go and book in to see your GP for pregnancy, they will just refer you to your local hospital most of the time. And unfortunately, some doctors are not supportive of midwifery-led care or home birth, so they will not offer you those options. And so women need to really consider what is the best model of care for them, because that model of care is going to make a huge impact on their pregnancy, labour and birth experience and their postpartum. We know from the research that having a known midwife care for you throughout your pregnancy actually decreases the risk of surgical birth, instrumental birth, intervention, and it also increases the woman's chance of responding as having a positive birth experience. It also improves the outcomes for babies as well, so clinical outcomes. So we know from there's strong research to support that your care provider will have a huge impact on your experience, both in a physical sense, the clinical outcomes, but also for how the woman experiences her experience. Yeah.
That's so true. I had read this baby book in New Zealand that was written by this well-known person. And then I, after I finished reading the book, I realized, oh, she lives just down the road from me. So I thought, oh, she can be my midwife. And my husband and I went to 3 appointments with her quite early on. And she just kept on talking about things that can go wrong. And It was funny because I didn't want to offend her by leaving. So I said to my husband, oh, I don't feel comfortable with her. Every time we walk in, they're very excited. And every time we leave, feeling so deflated and scared. And I said to him, but I really, you know, I don't, bit of a people pleaser, don't like confrontation. So I was like, I can't tell her that I don't want to work with her anymore. But also within myself, I knew that if I stayed with this woman, something horrible was going to happen, just because I just felt horrible every time I left there. And he was really good. He supported me. He was like, yep, no, we're going to have to tell her. We have to leave and find somebody else. And it was so hard because it was my first. I look back now and I'm like, oh my God, what a worse seller. Very different things right now. But I was so scared. And I made that phone call. And I was like, I can't go ahead. I probably made some like stupid excuse. Found myself an unbelievable midwife. And I actually called up this midwifery center. I said, who is your most hippie, holistic midwife that you have? And they said, Kate Rankin, call her. And Kate just empowered me. And do you know the gift that she gave me is every time I said to her, oh, Kate, you know, what should I do if my baby does this or that? And her answer to everything is, what do you think? What do you think? And I'm like, oh, I'm allowed to think. I have a choice in this. Oh, I hadn't really thought about it. I was so used to people just telling me what to do. And so she really put that power back in my hands and made me feel like, oh, I have a say in all of this. Oh, I actually have a little voice that I can listen to. So like, that's my big thing. I just want us to get back in touch with that little voice. And so what you're saying there, Bo, about the care provider, that is so important. But then also, how do we do that? I don't know what it's like over in Queensland, but you know, it's about $5,000 to get a private midwife. In New Zealand, the midwifery system is completely free. So I never paid a cent for either of my babies and I could have whichever midwife I wanted. How can we not have that in Australia? New Zealand's a pretty small country. I mean, how can they do it and we don't have it over here?
We need women to campaign for this. We need women. That's why we're here raising this awareness that this is an option. But there's lots of, as I said, to become an endorsed midwife, lots of red tape, but we need the consumers to really ask for it. And even things simple as like in the hospital here, we haven't had sterile water injections as an option for pain management. And again, I trained using them. It was very standard option. There's no drugs involved and it does offer a lot of women really good pain management. And it's,
I want to hear more about that.
I
haven't heard about that. Tell me more. Yeah. What is it?
So it works on the gait control theory, where if we put some pressure or something at the lower back, we are blocking the pain pathways to the brain. So if a woman has lower back pain, similar to using a TENS machine or even counter pressure or massage at the sacrum, so what we do is we inject a tiny 0.1 or 0.2 mils of sterile water in under the skin into the woman's lower back. We do that normally with 2 midwives and we do it at 4 points at the lower back over the sacrum. And it does sting quite a lot. I've had them myself. And it kind of gives you, I guess, like a really, really strong bee sting for a few minutes. Once that goes away, it gives incredible pain relief. So it's just blocking that pain pathway to the brain. So the pain is very much reduced. For me, it took all pain away. But we haven't had that for years in WA. And it wasn't until I started campaigning at my hospital, but also I started telling women in my classes, ask for sterile water injections, ask for sterile water injections. And just this week I've found out that one hospital has started using them. So it's just getting the message out there and getting women to make their voice be heard as well.
So the first step is education. Like, the women have to know at the beginning that they can choose what kind of experience they want, what kind of journey they want through this. Because if they just are going to their GP and getting referred onto the hospital, then it all goes by and they don't know any of it. So there has to be, like what you're doing, with offering people the education to find out these different options early on in their journey, I think is so important.
Mm-hmm. I've always kind of thought we need to go into schools and educate kids, because as Sarah said, she's heard children saying that they've heard these awful birth stories and I don't want to have a baby because it's too painful. We have to get in before they even start hearing those stories to let them know about what normal birth can be, so that they don't even have those stories not even coming into their head before they become teenagers and young adults. So I don't know if we can start a school program.
That would be,
I agree. Yeah.
Definitely. And Sarah, you said something before we started recording just about that rawness, that empowerment, that like stepping into womanhood, like motherhood, this incredible primal power that we have within us when we give birth. That thing that you said before we started recording, say that again.
Well, who knows what I said, but I think every woman has this internal power, and I think men have their own version of their internal power, and it'll get ignited through a different experience. But for women, there is something that gets ignited in you when you are going through labor that I don't think anything else, in my experience, and I've got two kids,
and mine.
Nothing else has ignited this, and it remains with you, this lioness, wild woman, raw power that you get, which kind of allows you to step into being that mama bear, protective. You'll do anything for your little cub. And I think you probably need that to keep them safe as they go through life. And I think maybe that's sort of part of why nature does it like that. But I think you can miss out on that experience, or the fullness maybe of that experience. So I can only speak from my experience, but when I think the more medical the birth is, I think the harder it would be to tap into that raw power. It's very hard to describe. And my first labor was very different to my second. And I felt it unbelievably strongly in my second and not that strongly in my first. And my first was much more medical than my second. So for me, it fits that this power that I did not know that I possessed at all, and just was basically, I was kind of born through that experience as well. I think my new identity, my new strength, and my new confidence in who I was and what I was capable of was born in that moment. And it's pretty euphoric. It is wild. It's loud. It's all of these amazing things that we're sort of not encouraged to be. And I would love to see women getting to a space where that is celebrated, that wild energy where women are raw and naked and ugly and amazing and beautiful and gorgeous and just in it, like just so in the messiness of it all. And so in control of it and working with the baby. And it's a real non-verbal communication between the mom through the body into the baby, and they're all working together. And I think it's the most amazing experience. And you and Beau get to be at that. I'm so jealous. I always had this thing that I wanted to be a midwife, and I just love that space. I'd love us to get back to a place where, yeah, that's really celebrated and that's how births go. And then the people that need the medical support get the medical support for whatever's happened in their pregnancy that's needed. You know, it creates that need for that extra support in a hospital system, if that's what they need. But birth, labor, it's not a medical event. It's a natural event. So I would love to see that go into the natural space. And then when a medical hiccup comes up, then people are there, the experts are there to be able to support them through whatever that needs to be and how that needs to progress. But yeah, women getting back into, you know, I'd love to see us all in fields and working with our village and going real old school with it, but we'll see.
So, Jess, for somebody who has got a medical condition and they know straight off the outset there's no way they're going to be able to have a natural birth,
yeah,
what are some things that they can do to still have an empowered experience?
So I still think they can be fully educated on everything that's going to be happening. And I think getting the right support people as well. So even if they knew maybe straight off the bat that they're going to be having an elective cesarean section, let's say, they could still get in extra support like doula, or, you know, some people get student midwives as well, so that they can still have that, all of that support there. They can still have, you know, their favorite music playing. They could still have all of their favorite affirmations. They could have, what else could they have? They could have a birth photographer. They can still make it such a celebrated experience because they're still bringing life into the world. They're still meeting their baby for the first time. So even if you know that it can't be quite as natural as some other people might get to experience it, I still think you can make it your own experience, even if it has to be more medicalized. So yeah, I still think education is a big part, because you can still learn about all the things that you can do to make it your own experience.
Yeah, you can still be getting the skin to skin,
yeah,
nice and quick, the delayed cord clamping, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
As long as it's like, there are certain situations where that's not suitable, obviously, yeah, but there are degrees of things that you can still include that change based on the circumstances. Yeah. But yeah, it's no, it is, it's all education, knowing all of the options out there.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you're going to want to add some bits too.
Yeah, I agree with Jess. And that's like the biggest thing for all women, but especially women having some type of medical intervention and things, is the most important thing is that they understand what is happening. Because even if it's not maybe what they planned, but they can still look back on the experience knowing that they understood what was happening to their body and why it was happening. And often they actually still have lots of options. They do. So just asking, are there any alternatives, or is there, can we not do that? Or there are lots of options still. One thing I think is just, you know, one of the biggest interventions in labour and birth is induction. And our Australian induction rates are way too high. And I guess I'd love to have a quick chat about this, because obviously homeopathy can help with this, but there's lots of options there. And I'm not a big advocate in encouraging women to trying all the options to get labour to begin, but especially if they are looking at potential medical induction. I had a woman recently, a client, who didn't know that she could decline an induction, and she had actually no risk factors at all. She was overdue, past her estimated due date, but very healthy pregnancy and baby, and she didn't realise she could just not go through with the induction. Like, they just said to her, you'd be induced at 40 and 10. And she, I told her, you don't have to be induced. And I did some acuneedling for her. So just addressing any issues that might be sort of holding up her body from relaxing or getting into the, sometimes the mind that is getting caught up and stopping labor from starting. And baby was actually quite malpositioned, and I did some acneedling points to try and help baby turn into a more optimal position, which actually did happen overnight. But I know homeopathy can help with these types of things too. So I just want women to know that there are other options. Maybe if you could mention a couple of things, like, because a couple of things is I feel like women are emotionally stressed in those last few days, and I feel like that emotional block gets in the way, whether it be fear of labour or sometimes they're just distracted by their other children, not wanting to leave their child at home when they're in labour, all of those things. Or just maybe their body is, often we have this mentality that pain in pregnancy is normal, but it's not. And a lot of, you know, in the forums you see, oh, I've got this horrible back pain, I can barely walk. And everyone says, oh, it's part of pregnancy. But it is common, but it's not really normal. It's the body telling you need to get some supports. And when those issues can be addressed, then the body is allowed to really relax into labour. Mm. So yeah, I'd love to chat about some options women can try.
Please. Induction is a huge one, and we probably should have even started with that, and we can do a whole podcast just on that. And, you know, how did we get to a place where we think that if somebody says to us you have to get an induction, that we don't even question that? If you get nothing out of today, then at least just please, if you get forced into an induction, hopefully Bo and Jess can give you some wording that you can use to stand up for yourself, because that is often the cascade that leads to the horror stories that we hear. It's the induction. It's rare that I hear inductions going well. In most cases that I see in clinic, it's just all goes downhill so fast. And I mean, I can't tell you about the amount of horror stories I hear of epidurals in the clinic. I mean, obviously we see clients who have issues, so we wouldn't get the nice epidural experience, wouldn't come and see me. It's all the ones that are the horrible ones, and there's so many of them. But induction, oh my God, Bo, talk to us about that. Jess, pipe in, Sarah, pipe in. Just give us all the info. If somebody, if you're a gynecologist, or, you know, if you're in a midwifery, in a community midwifery program as well, I think they can't really take you past a certain point as well. So like, how much can a pregnant woman push back? Talk to us a little bit about that, and what can they say, and what are their options?
I made a recent Instagram post about the BRAINS acronym. And I think that's just like that. If you're going to have one tool, just use that. So it's, if somebody's suggesting an intervention to you, if you use this acronym BRAINS, so you ask, what are the benefits? What are the risks? What are the alternatives?
What's the intuition?
I know Bo has used that one too. Yeah, intuition. And then N.
Oh my gosh, it's totally.
What if you do nothing?
Nothing.
Like, is it an option just to do nothing?
Yeah. And S, can I have some space to think about it?
Amazing.
Yeah. So it makes you kind of, it makes sure that you have all of the information. It's not just somebody saying, we're going to book you in for an induction. And I would say most people wouldn't ask all of these questions to somebody. So your doctor or the midwife might actually be a little bit taken aback that somebody's asking so many questions about it. So don't be surprised if they are a little bit. But I feel like if you are offered an intervention and you ask all of these questions, then you at least know that you're making a fully informed choice about whether you're going to be saying yes or no, or I'd like an extra few days to think about it. And it just, even if you do end up deciding to have an induction, then you've made a fully informed choice. And then you can kind of know in yourself, okay, this is the right choice for me, because I know all of the information. I know that I've made the right choice for myself and for my baby and for my whole family.
Also, you can ask for the evidence, because that's what I tell a lot of women, ask them for the statistics and the actual evidence, because unfortunately, you know, we are evidence-based practitioners. We are meant to base our advice on what is the top quality evidence. But unfortunately, that does not happen a lot of the time, or it's misinterpreted. Like, I have a lot of women who say, oh, my doctor said if I go overdue, the rate of stillbirth increases by double. And that's like, whoa, I'm never going to risk that. Why would anyone want to risk doubling the risk of their baby not surviving? But if you go actually look at the evidence, the percentage is literally like, well, it depends on the circumstances, but there's research that shows it goes from 0.44 to 0.9. It's this minute percentage of risk. And not to discredit that risk, when it's delivered in the sense of the stillbirth risk increases by double, that's really fear-mongering. And for a woman in that vulnerable position, she doesn't want to do the wrong thing for her baby, of course. So just, you have the option to say, okay, can you provide that research or that evidence to show that stillbirth risk or those risks that you're telling me about? Because I really appreciate seeing the statistics and what that actually means to me.
That's great advice. And I think for any, in any medical situation ever, you know, asking your doctor or your primary care provider for evidence of what it is that the claims that they're making, because I hear horror stories in clinic as well of these types of things that are told to pregnant women and just my clients in general when they're in a hospital type setting. And often the claims are unfounded, and the few women in my clinic who are really empowered and who will stand up to the medical profession and say, okay, well, show me evidence, quite often the medical professional will have nothing back to say. Oh, I've heard this story somewhere or something along those lines. So yeah, definitely. And that kind of gives you a bit of space as well. I love that BRAINS acronym. Can you just run us past it again? So B was for?
Benefits.
Risks.
Alternatives.
Intuition.
Intuition.
Nothing. What if you do nothing? Yeah. And S?
Space.
Excellent. I hope our listeners are writing that down and putting it on your phone. So if you have baby brain and you go for your gynae appointment, that if you forget, you can just quickly take your phone for the acronyms. Yeah. And that's brilliant advice. And then asking for the evidence. If claims like that are being made, showing what the evidence is. Anything else that we can chat about with induction? I was actually thinking, Sarah, do you want to throw out some remedies there that you've had success with moving things along?
Yeah, well, the famous remedy is colophyllum for homeopaths to use. It's a gorgeous remedy. Semifuga is often used as well. Sometimes people will use them intercurrently with each other. But you want to make sure, like Bo said, I'm not overly keen on inducing before ready. I don't think there's any point in forcing anything. The path of least resistance is going to be your best path, and go with what's happening. So like we've been talking about giving women or allowing them to hold on to their power, but power doesn't equal control, and women can fall into, when trying to keep hold of their power, and control can be a big word that comes up, and we want to try and control the situation and manage it. And it isn't really in our control, this process. And so going with what your body needs is very important. So when contractions start, if you've reached your due date and you're getting some good Braxton Hicks, then I think it's a good time to start colophyllum. If you have that additional pressure of an induction being thrown at you or being suggested strongly to you, or there's talk of, okay, we're going to need to start looking at a cesarean or anything like that, and that's not what you feel is medically needed, then I think utilizing remedies like colophyllum or semifuga or sometimes even pulsatilla. And I would like to see that there's already something happening. You're at least feeling some Braxton Hicks, something's going on, but you're not just sitting at home taking the remedy. And I want to see that you're out going for big long walks. You're doing all these other things that are going to be bringing it on as well. Homeopathy is not this magic pill on its own. You have to bring in your lifestyle, your whole presence has to be brought into this process. And you're not outsourcing this process to homeopathy either. You are, it has to be the woman involved. So it's not sit at home and take colophyllum and wait for the baby to come. It's get out walking, doing what you're meant to be doing. Bo and Jess would have lots of advice about the activities you can do to naturally bring on contractions and labor and make sure they're effective and your body's sort of warming up to this process. But it's going to be doing it anyway in the background. You just may not have felt them yet. But yeah, once they're established, but maybe not doing, they're not as strong as they need to be, or they're not as consistent as they need to be at that point, that's when homeopathy can really tone the situation and focus your system into what it's meant to be focusing on and get the whole thing started. So yeah, they're my two favorites for inducing, but it's not really inducing. It's just focusing that moment in the process.
That's such a good point. I personally feel like the baby's due date is kind of parenting lesson 101. Like we try to control our children from a very young age. Be quiet, do this, do that, don't do that. But this parenting lesson actually starts before they're born, of like, mum, I will arrive when I'm ready. Yeah. You're not going to force me into this. So I always just feel like this is the first, there's surrenders along the way, but this is like kind of that first ultimate surrender of the baby's going to come when they're ready. There's nothing you can do to force this process. Well, there are things that you can do to force it, but there's often a price that you pay afterwards. I think that with my son, my mum was flying out the next day. And she'd come over and from overseas, and I desperately wanted her to be there for the birth. And so I did the whole castor oil thing. Yes, Bo, I was. It did nothing, but I think it was because I had actually taken red raspberry capsules and tea excessively from 30 weeks onwards. So there was like this contraindication, I think. And so I'd taken that, I did the castor oil, I did the acupressure on the feet. Unbelievably, I didn't do homeopathy, but I was only a second year student then. So I think maybe I wasn't confident in using that. But my mum and I did these acupressure points on my feet. And I think we did induce him because he was only one day over, and first babies often are over, very much over, and he was only like 1 or 2 days over his due date. So the surges were quite intense for about 24 hours. And luckily I had done hypnobirthing. So I did my surge breathing through all of it. So it was absolutely fine. I labored at home, zero drugs. But I know because my second birth, it was started at 8 p.m. She's born at midnight. No issues. Like it was, and second births are easier. But I know for a fact that first birth went on that long because I had pushed things and they were quite ready. So I always feel that there's always a price to pay if we're pushing a natural process. If we just beautifully let it unfold as it should, if we trust nature, if we just surrender to the lessons that the beautiful, amazing, empowering lessons that we learn in this incredible process, then it can be such a beautiful experience.
They often say that first-time mums will go into labor around 41 weeks and 3 days, which is usually around the time that they kind of buck an induction. So if we just didn't buck the induction and let women have their babies, they'd probably have them around the same time anyway.
Exactly. The other thing is, what are some other routine tests that you ladies see that people can actually, the client, I know like ultrasounds are an interesting one. I didn't never really realize that there are potential negative effects from it until I read Sarah Buckley's book, Gentle Birth, Gentle Mothering. And she talks about ultrasounds in there. And I always ask my clients in consultation how many ultrasounds that you have in pregnancy. And often they'll be between like 6 or 10 or even more. And the classic is they'll say, oh, the child has stopped growing. We need to scan you every week. But actually there's evidence showing that ultrasounds can lead to intrauterine growth retardation. So you're now excessively scanning this person for intrauterine growth retardation, which is actually caused by excess scans. And so you can just say no. I've often said to mums, well, you could just conveniently become sick that day and not go to, like, you know, things, you don't have to go to these appointments. Yeah. What are they going to do if you don't turn up for your ultrasound? Are they going to turn up with handcuffs at your home and say, no, you have to go for your ultrasound? You don't actually have to go.
I think women really like ultrasounds, though. I think there's that control thing gets brought into it, and the fear as well, because you can't, there's no little window in. This is your little moment. It's a bit of a disconnecting from your natural connection with your child. Yes. And again, kind of being able to sort of see it through a third party rather than connecting. I know I definitely would have loved to have seen my baby more just to make sure everything was okay. I'd had quite a few miscarriages and I had that fear of something's going to go wrong. But I was talking to our mom, and when she's had 4 kids and she took a pregnancy test, and then she had a baby 9 months later. There was no scan in between. Our older sister was over 3 weeks past the due date. And there was no sense of anything. Like, it was just, back then in Ireland, it was, you're pregnant. Great. In 9 months, you'll have a baby. Congratulations. There was no tests or anything to happen in between. And so it was a very unmedical pregnancy back then. But I really sympathize with, or I understand that desire to have a bit of knowing that things are okay with the baby and the pregnancy. But I think it disempowers you from connecting with your intuition and your internal knowing about it. I think you are handing over that power again. I think it's just another example of handing that over and not really trusting. But if you have experienced loss in pregnancy, I think it's a great opportunity to help with that, support that, try and deal with that so you can have, it's going to help your labor, it's going to help the pregnancy, it's going to calm down the system, it's going to make sure your sympathetic nervous system is not in fight or flight mode the whole time. It's going to make sure the oxytocin's flowing at the right time and the cortisol's low and all of those things. But I think that's such a common thing that people have experienced these losses. And then when they get pregnant again, they have this gripping fear that something's going to go wrong and they didn't know last time. So this might, if I keep getting scanned, I'm going to know. It's not going to necessarily prevent anything, but I'll know sooner. Yeah. I think I won't get my hopes up, all of that.
Yeah, it's definitely, as you said, you could just pretend to be sick that day. But if somebody who's wearing a white coat is telling me, oh, your baby's small, you need to get a scan every week, does that fear there? Some people might be okay with not getting the scan. You could easily just want to see that baby every single week to make sure everything's okay. And I get to see its little face and you get to see its heartbeat. And yeah, I think this, Beau, you're already talking about the fear, like fear is such a big part of our maternity system at the moment, and it can be very detrimental in so many forms. But yeah, I think if somebody's telling you that your baby is small, you can go have a scan and see that everything's okay. I think most people would say yes.
But maybe we can just give our listeners some advice then, like, if that, because at the end of the day, it's an you need to make an empowered decision either way, an informed, empowered decision. And whatever you decide, you need to be okay with that, so that there's not grief and guilt and regret and things eating you up afterwards. And I guess one of the ways you could do that is taking the homeopathic ultrasound remedy. I give it to my clients in a 200C before, one dose before, one dose straight after, and then three times daily for, you know, a couple of days. But then also maybe ask, like, requesting things like having a quick scan. So just a quick 5-minute scan, or as quickly as possible, things, not an excessively long scan. So you can play along in the system, but within your own boundaries. I think that is an important message too. It's like, for example, whether it's delayed cord clamping, if your obstetrician says no, he completely refuses, and then you go, okay, maybe can I just 10 minutes, 15 minutes then? And he says no, can I have 10 minutes? Okay, you can have 10 minutes, so that there's a negotiation, so that at no point you ever feel like somebody said, or if it's an induction, you're getting induced on this day. No, I can't on that day. I have my auntie's birthday. Okay, then this day. No, I can have it on this day. So you're extending it to a day that's right for you, not just that you feel empowered every single step of the way, even if it does need to be done within a system that, you know.
Yeah, and then I think that's where the space in the brain's acronym comes in, the space to just decide. I think my experience with, not my personal experience with the medical system so much as my experience in clinic, is that when you are told something medically, it feels like you have no space and no time. Mm-hmm. You make an immediate decision and you are not allowed that breathing room to ask further questions. Because I think when you're in a consultation and someone has told you something negative, your brain shuts down in some way. We remember when our dad was going through his cancer journey and he'd come home from his consultations and we'd be like, what did they say? And he's like, oh, I don't remember. We're like, someone has to go in with them. And eventually people were in with them and we'd be like, what did they say? We can't remember either. Like, people go blank in those situations and they react rather than respond. And that I think that is a natural stress response. The expectation for people in that situation to be able to sort of calmly go through brains and that kind of system and ask for more, I don't know if it's our natural response that the majority of people, I don't think that's how the majority of people would react in that situation. So I think what you had said about having that support of women, or having already created that support of who your care provider is, you're going to have maybe a different experience in the first place, but having that information around you that you can access, I think allows that to be a possibility. Now, some people are built like that, where they can just be like, hold up, that's not what I wanted. That's not what I've signed up for. I don't know if I'd respond like that in that situation. I think I might get a bit flustered, even with my years of experience of being a homeopath, having had two kids. I think I still might get a bit flustered if someone in a supposed authority figure and an expert position has told me something negative or something that I must do. I don't know how well I would handle that, needing that space to think. As soon as I get in the car, I'd probably be like, oh, I could have asked this. I should have, handled it this way. But in that moment, I think it's a challenge. I think the system is set up in a way, and I don't think this is intentional, but I think the way the system is set up, it doesn't allow for that time. Like you were saying, there isn't that time to sit with someone to make sure they're okay. Mm. These are your options. How do you feel about it? That extra level of care and support, I don't really see that. I think there's exceptional circumstances where it does exist, but the majority, I don't think that's how the big hospitals work here. And in Ireland, it'd be the same.
Yeah.
So I think it's a real challenge for women to be able to stand up for themselves in that moment, because if they don't have that prior education and know what questions to ask and know that there are all these other possibilities, they're not going to be told them in those moments and by that kind of care provider. So it's such a challenge. And often our job is going to be picking up the pieces after that. It's going to be band-aiding the situation later, and not really band-aiding, but, you know, we're going to be sort of helping them through that, whether it's, if Jessica does some trauma work, whether it's doing it like that, whether it's getting them now ready for birth, whether you and I, Eugenie, are going to be helping them and those soon with future ultrasounds, or if they're going to be tested for strep and what they can do at that stage. But I just think, yeah, I think it's a real challenge that women, or they don't necessarily already know how to handle those situations, and it doesn't create that space for them to be able to do it easily. No one's there saying, okay, let's give you some time before you give me an answer. That's a big challenge. Yeah.
And just on that too, when a woman's in labor and she is experiencing pain, most often she cannot make an informed decision. Mm-hmm. And care providers and women need to realize that, because I can even look back on my own labor and birth experience and see the stark difference in the way I made decisions when I first had to transfer. I planned a home birth, but I transferred to hospital and I came in a lot of pain with my baby posterior. And I consented to things that I absolutely did not plan to. And I was very vulnerable. I was in a lot of pain. My mind was not in the right space to make those decisions. And once I actually ended up needing an epidural, once I made that, the way I responded to decisions was very different, because the pain was gone and I became very assertive.
Oh, interesting.
And yeah, it was a stark difference. And the problem there is that another huge intervention in labor is going to hospital. That is one huge intervention that occurs. And once you go from the comfort of your own home to a foreign environment where you're on the clock, really, and you're in pain, you make decisions, especially early on, if you're not maybe in established labour, those decisions do affect the way your labour progresses, very much so, like getting early epidurals and things like that. That's what we teach in my active birth workshop, is really trying to manage the pain early on, look after yourself early on, stay hydrated and all of that to keep you well to get into established labour. And then if you need pharmacological pain management later on, that is a better time. But yeah, making decisions while you're in that type of pain is really not what we call informed decision making. And I remember the junior doctor coming into my labour with looking at the CTG, starting to talk about cesarean because there were some concerns. And I was telling her, no, it's fine. I'm happy with my CTG. And absolutely did not need a cesarean, let me tell you that one. Yeah, huge difference. And that is also why, of course, we don't need an epidural to make good decisions, but we need at least a good team. First of all, good care provider, primary care provider, who will advocate for your wishes, even if things change, like mine changed from the environment I planned to birth in. But then I had someone else look after me who wasn't my primary midwife, so that definitely interrupted things. But also your partner or your doula, your birth support team can speak up for you and sort of go, okay, well, that's not what you planned. Do you want to take a minute to think through that, or help you sort of make the right decisions for yourself, even when you're experiencing pain and exhaustion as well?
You're in an altered state, hey? It's not something that you can ever really describe to anyone, but at the same time, it's also such an incredible life-changing experience.
And homeopathically, in that moment, you want to make sure your support team, the ones that you've brought in with you, if you're using homeopathy in labor, they need to be trained in what remedies you need when, because good luck you figuring out what remedy you need in that moment. You'll just be taking arnica because you won't know how to say anything else. They need to know what to be able to hand you when different things are happening. They really need the training more than the woman in labor, I think. I think it's the partners.
Yeah. And maybe some Calipos for the partner.
Yeah.
Probably some aconite as well.
Yeah.
My husband was a bit traumatized afterwards. He was the second time around, he was like, I'm not going to look down there as things are happening. And then he walked past, but there was a mirror, and then he saw some things he didn't want to see. So he needed some trauma therapy. Not really. No, I'm just joking. He just still talks about that. But yeah, he's fine. Ladies, what is a final empowering message that you can leave for our mamas, whether it's first time or multiple times that they've given birth, a final message that you want to leave with them? And I didn't prepare for this one, so I'll go first so that you can have a little think. But my number one thing is just, we all have this incredible intuition, that little voice inside of you. We all have it. It's just often she gets drowned out by all the voices around her. So my one thing is just listen to that little voice. She's there for you all the time. Just listen to her.
That was going to be my one.
No, don't say that. Well, I have another one. And that was, spend at least double as much research as you can on your birth choices to how much you spend on researching your stroller.
Mm, yes.
Bo, do you have some advice?
Yeah, my biggest thing would be really take a consideration and choose wisely who your care provider is. And if you don't feel like you've got many options, just ask around, inquire as to what else might be there. Private midwife is not for everyone, but the money is worth every cent. And like, again, yeah, women spending $1,000 on a pram, but won't, you know, spend that on, say, a doula for beautiful support along the way and things. And also just know that you have so many options. Like, labor and birth is never the same for every person or even every pregnancy. But also that we don't need to look after you the same as the last woman. Women have so many different preferences. And the most important thing, especially in labor, is protecting your space, making you feel safe and in control, and anything that promotes the release of the beautiful hormone oxytocin for labor to progress well. And that goes for anyone, you know, in the room, ensuring that you feel safe and comfortable and as relaxed as possible. All of those things make a huge impact on how your experience is.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just turn inward, trust, you've got this, and don't be quiet about the journey you want. Mm-hmm. Be loud about the experience you want. Yeah,
I like that. Can I just take everybody's and make it into one?
Oh, I will just also add one last thing. If you're not happy with your care, definitely speak to your care provider if you feel comfortable. But if you need to take it further, ask to speak to the manager or in that program, or if you're not really getting the response you need in that space, you can, especially if it's a hospital-based system, contact the patient liaison officer of your hospital, because they are really wonderful support and they're sort of like outside of the actual model of care, but they can advocate for you. And sometimes it might be a misinterpretation of something or something like that, where they can really just advocate for you and find you a different option or something like, or just speak up for you if you're not feeling comfortable.
Amazing. Was there something else you want to add, Jess?
It's probably kind of tapping onto everybody else's, but I think, yeah, Bo, you were saying, think about the kind of birth that you want and the kind of support that you want, and then choose your care provider. Mm. Don't do it the other way around. So don't just choose your care provider and then be like, these are the things that I want, because that person might not be able to give that to you. Mm-hmm. So think about what you want first. So that might mean that you have to do all of this research first before you choose somebody. And as you said, Bo, as well, you can change your care provider during that process. So if you feel like every time you have an appointment with them and you come out and you're feeling disempowered and disappointed with what they've said, that person's probably not for you. So look at changing to somebody else. Mm. I think that's
amazing. Ladies, thank you so much. I was so looking forward to today. It was lovely to hang out with you. And I know our listeners are going to get a lot out of today's episode. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. See you later.
See ya.